Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Hi, I'm Sarah Smith. If you're the type of person that goes to Liberty as other people would go on safari, and the fact that John Lewis doesn't have a funeral service makes you fret, Sarah Smith cleaning cloths are for you. Sarah Smith, available from Sainsbury's, for the posher washer. Proud sponsors of Dumpty Dum.
This is Dumpty Dum, the show about the reality docudrama that sets an ambush in the heart of the Midlands. I'm the joint master of the hunt, who is Royfield Brown, and with me I have the landowner, nice guy farmer, who is...
David Archer.
Also known as...
Oh, right, Tim Bentinck.
And we also have the missing in action, one-eyed ballroom dancing milkman, who is...
Mike Tucker, also known as Terry Malloy.
We've got the biggies for you today, folks. Now, today's rendition of Bart Green is brought to you by my girl Vicky Cold in Kenya, who is knocking out wonderful rhythm on those African drums. Probably noticed at the top of the shop, didn't mention Lucy, because there is no Lucy today, because it's half term. So you're stuck with us three, looking back at some of the actors who have passed on or have left the show. Tim and Terry.
Hello.
Could you remind the listeners how long you've been part of the cast? Why don't you go first, Tim?
I'm not as long as Terry. I'm 34 years. How long are you, Tom?
43 years, mate. Man and boy. Yeah, well, mostly boy, but, you know, there we go. My manhood will come eventually, I'm sure.
Yeah. So, Terry, do you still see Tim as a bit of a novice, if he's, you know...
He's what they call an incomer, isn't he? You know, you've got to be there for 50 years before even considered part of Ambridge, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a foreigner, basically.
A foreigner, absolutely.
Gents, with a show that's been running since 1951, actors leaving or, dare I say, passing on must happen quite often. Are there any rituals or anything that the cast does to observe actors that have passed away?
There's not a set ritual, no. I mean, it's the same as when any friend goes, you know, if you can, you go to the funeral, you write letters, mm-hmm. you miss them, they're not there anymore, they leave a gap. But that's the extraordinary thing about the Archers, because it happens in real time, in a way that it wouldn't happen in a play on stage, in a film or in a telly. The only equivalent really would be for it to happen in a long-running television series like, you know, Coronation Street or EastEnders or something like that. Because it all happens in real time, when the actor dies, usually the character dies with it. If the actor sadly dies, you know, a bit young, then they can be recast and have been. But usually if they're of a good age, then the character will pass away. That's quite strange, because you have sort of two deaths. You know, you have the death of the actor and then you have the death of the character. So it's a sort of double whammy, isn't it, Terry?
Very much so. And I mean, obviously, people will die and perhaps die suddenly. And the programme sometimes looks for a way to maintain that character, not necessarily vocally on screen, but for a time, and then let them go. I mean, I think the exception to that was when Graham Roberts died, that his family wanted him to die on the program as well at the same time. And it was it had to be done because they didn't want him hanging around in the air, if you like, for years afterwards. It has to be handled with sensitivity, you know, and there are dramatic deaths. There are very gentle passing aways, as I'm sure we will discuss as we go through the program. Mm.
Tim, you came into the Archers in, I believe, 1982.
I did.
So you can remember Margot Boyd entering the Archers in 84 as the Hound Lady. What was it like working with her?
She was, I think she was called the Dog Woman more than the Hound Lady. Well, she was exceptional. Margot was a true eccentric, and she was a character all of her own. She was one of the funniest women I think I've ever met.
Right, everybody, Now, as you know, you are completely free to do what you like. Completely free, but I do strongly recommend a trip to the museum in Burlington Street.
No, who wants to come to the seaside to look at a museum?
They have the most interesting Iron Age relics.
She should know.
Now, about our return trip, we'll see the 4:30 prompt. And I mean...
She was always dressed impeccably. She always wore a sort of this two-piece wool suit. I don't know what it's called. What's a suit where it's got a skirt? You know, she didn't wear trousers.
It was Margaret Rutherford, really, wasn't it?
She looked like Margaret Rutherford. Yeah. Her white hair was impeccably done, absolutely perfectly. And she was apparently absolutely immune to the effects of alcohol and cigarettes, which she devoured with some aplomb all through the day. But she never, ever appeared to be drunk. She had a permanent smile on her very made up face. She had a face that was completely plastered in makeup, and had a poise and a style and a wicked and naughty and dirty sense of humour.
Completely.
The like of which, I mean, I'll drop here. I've got a book deal. I'm writing an autobiography, and these things I'm having to go back and go to, and it's awful when you write down and say it's the funniest woman I've ever met, and then you can't think of any gags. So I've been going around the car saying, "Can you think of any great Margot-isms? Can you remember any good ones, Terry?"
I mean, there was a wonderful time when we were actually doing the stage play, A Murder at Ambridge Hall. And because we were utilising the fact that we could actually have voices coming in on the telephone. And we asked Margot if she would record a little bit for the show to be played in at some point, you know. And she was in one of her times, she was in her flat in London. And she said, "Oh, yes, just call darling. Send somebody round, send somebody round." And so we sent the sound recordist round. And he very nearly didn't get out of the flat alive, you know. She was plying him with scotch. And Ringo said, "Oh, that was a terribly nice man you sent round. Have him come back. She was naughty.
She was. I did a video when we left Pebble Mill. There was a party to leave Pebble Mill, and Paddy Green, plays Jill, made a speech which I've got recorded. And she recalls Margot on the telephone to a costume department giving her dimensions. Mm. And she just said, 42, 42, 42. That's what she was.
Yes.
She was sort of square.
Yeah.
She was great. And she still much missed. We need, you know, it's characters like that made the program for me when I came into it, surrounded by barking mad people. I mean, you know, the very individual and strange, and people who'd come from different walks of life, as opposed to, you know, we're all actors now. But it wasn't like that in the early days, was it?
Although Margot was an actor.
I mean, sorry, an actress. But
I mean, there were lots of country people, if you like. Like, dear old Bob Arnold, you know, he was a countryman, as was Molly Harris. There was that immense depth and texture of voices that, you know, in the days when I came in, you know, early 70s, that was just amazing to listen to in the studio and obviously on the radio as well.
Now, talking about voices, Arnold Peters, who played Jack Woolley, had a very distinct Brummie accent. Yeah. I didn't realise until today that there actually were two Jack Woolleys. So, Terry, could you tell us about the first Jack Woolley, who died in 1979?
This was Philip Garston Jones. I mean, he was He was wonderful. I mean, he was an actor of the old school. Terribly, terribly refined. He lived in Henley and Arden. And I think he was on the council, on the whatever the local meet or whatever it was in Henley at the time. He was one of the council or the town councillors or something. He was phenomenally astute at going through everything that we did. I didn't realise how famous he was. I mean, I made the gross mistake about a year or so after I joined that I just met Philip and he was this sort of rather nice, bumbling old chap who, you know, told us about things, but did a wonderful Jack Woolley. And he joined the cast. I was working at Birmingham Rep, and he came in to play the butler in Importance of Being Earnest or something or other. And I just breezed in, and he said, "Oh, Terry, I'll be joining you at the Birmingham Repertory Theatre soon." I said, "Oh, good old Philip, joining the professionals at last." And there was a deathly silence. Everyone just looked at me. It was one of those awful... the man who said the wrong word, you know, and I went, Philip, I apologize deeply. But he used to go through every omnibus, and in those days they used to cut bits out, so that you'd always know there was an omnibus cut coming up, because you'd be talking about vegetation or something or other. But on the day after the omnibus began, you were in studio, say, "Oh, Terry, three omnibuses for you," because they were paid separately. If you got an omnibus, three omnibus fees for you, Terry. He'd note everybody's omnibus's fees. It was great. Bless him, and he had this wonderfully rich, he was terribly posh, but he puts on Jack Woolley and he becomes this old, you know, this curmudgeonly old feather. He was lovely, and, you know, sadly, he went the way that many people do. I mean, because he was fairly elderly when I joined the programme. So, then we moved on to a new Jack Woolley. Mm.
Do you remember how long the gap was between Philip passing and Arnold taking up the mantle of Jack Woolley?
I don't think it was that long, actually. I mean, they tend to, if they're going to maintain a character, they will probably drop him out for 6 months at least to get people to almost forget what the voice was like and then bring the new one in. I don't think it was much more than a year before Arnold Peters came in as Jack. And Arnold had already been in the programme before as several other characters in the early days. I can't remember the names they were now. But he was one of the farmhands in the early days of the Archers. Mm. He knew the programme anyway.
One of the most poignant things about Arnold is obviously he plays Jack, and Jack is diagnosed with having Alzheimer's. And then short after starting to play that part of Jack's life, Arnold himself was diagnosed as having Alzheimer's. Yeah. How did the cast feel about that, with the fact that, you know, he still played that role for a time?
It was quite extraordinary because he was displaying the signs of Alzheimer's. You know, we'd be sitting in the green room and he'd be his normal, usual, cheery self, and he'd be coming in and asking you questions about the, you know, house family, and it was so that and you know, chat, and you'd tell them and you'd this and that and so and so, and then he'd do that awful thing that happens with dementia or Alzheimer's. He'd repeat it. He'd start again, and you'd have to go through it all over again. But then he would then go into the studio with this script and play the part of a man getting Alzheimer's with the same professionalism and aplomb that he had always brought to the part, and nothing changed at all. So his ability to be able to do the job didn't change in the slightest bit. Mm. And that was very poignant and sad. And, you know, then, as you can imagine, there came a point where I can't remember whether it was his decision. I think it was probably, I would imagine it was a sort of mutual decision that that he should retire. Yeah. And then what happened, Terry? What happened to the character? Did he then became silent, didn't he? And then eventually
he became silent and was in the home. And, you know, because you've also got the, you know, the amazing fact that June's husband, her husband in real life, had gone through the same process.
So that's right,
June,
of course,
was again reliving the whole aspect of Alzheimer's with a character in the program, but also somebody she'd worked alongside who was also getting Alzheimer's. I mean, it was for June, it must have been an immense strain, and she you know, she bore it brilliantly. But yes, I mean, there came a time when Arnold, you know, had to go into a home, into a hospice. And I think it was around that time that they did record a couple of
actually there, yeah.
At that place, yeah.
At the home, yeah. Yeah. His last recording on the Archers was...
I think was at the home,
was there, yeah.
You see those pretty shiny colours? That's enamel. You remember Ted?
Ted?
Violet's husband. No? Well, anyway, Ted's been teaching me how to do enamelling, and I was wondering what to make. And I thought, I know, I'll make a birthday present for Jack.
Oh, you're very kind.
Shall I put it on for you?
Oh, thank you. Blue, like the bird.
Oh, the blue tit on your card.
On my card?
Yes, it's just the same colour, isn't it? There, how's that? Oh, yes, that looks very nice.
Very nice.
Now, you ready for some tea?
Look.
What?
All the cards.
Oh, yes, what a lot of cards you've got. So many good friends who still remember your birthday. Aren't you lucky?
Yes. Aren't I lucky?
Yeah. I actually had the privilege of working with him in television as well. I did. I was doing a sitcom series with Chris Berry called A Prince Among Men, and I played his sort of ghastly business manager. And Arnold played the part of this of a guy who owned a factory that was that we'd bought, and we were going to make everybody redundant and sack him. So I came in as this absolute, you know, bastard coming in to sack him. And Arnold played it. And, you know, proved that he was, you know, not just a radio actor. He was in vision and in close-up. He was absolutely fantastic. He was a consummate actor. He was, you know, he was the real deal.
He was. And he had a radio program on in Northamptonshire, and he did a lot of work with the amateur companies, directed lots of stuff there. And he used to give us the back end of his wisdom from time to time. Certainly myself and Trevor, you know, if we'd be doing something, he'd say, "Oh, that's terribly unprofessional, Teddy, Trevor. Oh, no, we shouldn't be doing that." So he said, "Oh, sorry about that, Arnold." Yeah. He was great because we toured with him and he was instrumental alongside with other of us setting up Archer's Addicts, and he'd sit in on meetings and say, "Oh no, well, what about the VAT?" It was his main question every time, was, "Well, what about the VAT?" And we'd have these great long meetings, and we say, "Do you want to bring up the VAT question again, Arnold?" You know? But it was great because he did have business acumen, and he had an input into what we were doing in the early days, which was very valuable. And you know, we loved him dearly, and I do remember we went on a cruise with him once, and getting off at the airport to come back, and he was going up the escalator with a case, and I was behind him with my wife, and we just saw him start to go backwards halfway up the escalator, and we were rushing up to hold him upright because the case was pulling him backwards. We thought, no, we don't need Arnold tumbling down an escalator backwards with this large case.
Well, talking about the high seas, Jack May, who played Nelson, was definitely one of the first voices that I really could remember, and just kind of fell in love with the rogue kind of antiques dealer, wine bar owner in the early 80s. Jack served with the Royal Indian Navy, back in the days when there was still an empire. Was Jack as cultured as Nelson?
He liked to think he was. He had the same voice. I mean, yes. there was no difference between his natural speaking delivery and the character.
How are you feeling?
Oh, not too bad, all things considered. You know what you were telling me the other day, Dad?
Huh? What's that?
How you were going to make a donation to the church fund.
Oh, yes, yes. But I ain't changed my mind.
You haven't given him the money yet, have you?
No. He said to wait.
He doesn't want to take your money, Dad.
He's not taking it. I'm giving it to the church.
You can't buy your way into heaven, you know.
I'm not trying to buy my way into anywhere. It's just that I'm not going to be greedy anymore. That's what I decided.
Dad?
Mm-hmm?
I'm in difficulties.
Oh, are you, son? What sort of difficulties? It's not that Jackie, is it? I never thought she was up to any good.
No, it's not Jackie. Though, Lord knows, she doesn't help matters.
Oh, have you got into debt?
Dad, I've been in debt since 1951. That isn't the point.
Again, I remember from when Paddy, when she was giving her farewell speech, she told a story about Jack May, and Jack had been out of the programme for a certain number of years. And the director said to him, "Jack, we now do the read-through in the narrator's room." And Jack, with this dry voice, said,
I see tremendous progress has been made in my absence. Yeah.
And, I mean, of course, what was so... I mean, again, there is me coming in 1982 to see this extraordinary relationship between Chris Gittins playing Walter Gabriel with the strangest voice you've ever... All right, these are going on like this. And his son was played by a man who spoke like that.
Yes,
oh,
yes.
No, do shut up, Dad. Oh. It was like, what kind of madhouse have I joined?
Yeah.
I always thought when I heard him on my radio, I just thought of Noel Coward. That's who I absolutely envisaged.
Yeah, he certainly had a stillness to him. I did radio plays with him, you know, and I remember very vividly at one point doing a play about King Charles hiding in the Royal Oak, and we actually filmed it at this home out near the A5, you know, when we had to wait till about midnight so that the traffic died down so we couldn't hear that in the background, you know. And then we were all being people on horseback clanking chains and jumping up and down on bits of board on the thing, and Jack was standing there with his coat up round his ears with this chain desultorily clanking in it occasionally, as I refuse to ride a horse on planks. and this terribly arch way. And certainly I remember when suddenly the smoking ban came across the BBC, you know, because in those early days, you know, everyone was smoking in the studio, you know.
Yeah, on mic. It was almost compulsory, wasn't it?
Yeah. But there was this notice put up outside in Pebble Mill, outside Studio 3, a large notice saying that as of such and such a date, smoking is prohibited in the building. And I remember Jack coming in for an episode and his coat was slightly up and he came over and just wandered over and looked at this note on the wall and then just flipped his lighter and set fire to it. Sat down and lit up. Yeah, UDI was declared.
Yeah. The character of Clary is an interesting one, as three actors have played her. We've had Rosalind Adams, Heather Bell and Fiona Matheson all taking it in turns to play the much set upon Grundy matriarch. The passing of Fiona from an overdose in 1987 must have hit everybody very hard.
Yes, it did. It was tragic. What it was it was postnatal depression, and she had a baby that she would really, really wanted, and she caught a train up to Scotland and she checked into a hotel and took an overdose there. And so the whole thing, it came as a terrible, terrible shock to all of us. She'd been in the programme not many years. I can't remember, but it was in... can you remember, Terry, sort of like two or three years, or yeah, was it longer
about,
than that?
No, it's only about maybe 4 years, yeah. Tops. I mean, the shock was the fact that you had somebody in your midst who you'd been working with and said goodbye to at the end of a recording session, and they cheerily said goodbye. There was no indication of what was about to happen.
No.
And it just makes you think, when I'm saying goodbye to people, do I really know what's happening there? You know, or do they know what's happening in my life? You know, you suddenly start to look at other people, the rest of the members of the cast that you're working with, and value them very much more because, you know, and I think we all tend to sort of build walls around ourselves at times and say, no, I'm fine, you know, and you're not fine underneath. And if somebody had been alongside her to perhaps on that day just you know how are you, you know, and maybe it's, you know, allowed her to offload some of the worry she had at that moment in time, maybe it may have been a totally different story.
No, that's very true. I mean, sometimes it can be cathartic, and sometimes you know, we do make very good friends up there.
Yeah.
And I've had times when I've been sitting in the green room with various close friends, and you know, people have said, "What's the matter, Tim?" You know, and I've told them, you know, and that's because they're mates, and that's what you do with friends. Other times, you know, and I'm sure we've all done this, where you go, "I don't really want to say
you know? Actually. Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And I just maintain a professional kind of, no, it's fine, you know, a professional distance. And so it can be one, you know, it can be both, but at its best, you know, the Archers is a kind of, for a lot of us, an extended family, and we have made friends over the years. I mean, for my own part, you know, Paddy is like a second mother to me, because my mum died when I was 13, and so, you know, coming into the program, and she's played my mother, and she sort of mothered me, you know, and I feel as that she does to most of the cast, but yeah. The fact that she plays my mum as well is sort of a double thing. She is a very maternal figure, and we, you know, so we do, we have very close relationships with some people, and that's true, Terry. I mean, if maybe she had been able to unburden it, maybe that wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, it's because we have this transient lifestyle where we see each other, you know, briefly sometimes for, you know, 2 or 3 hours, and then maybe not see that person again for 4 or 5 months or, you know, whatever, depending on the storylines. And it's sometimes difficult to make those close relationships with members of the cast. They are close in that we're part, as Tim says, part of that extended family, but they're also distant as well. You pick up where you were. You assume things were as they were the last time you met that person, maybe 6 months ago. And we shouldn't make those assumptions. We should actually challenge those and actually say, well, I've moved on. I've had problems. Let's explore those. But it takes working with somebody alongside them a lot on mic to have that relation, that real relationships where there is that actual coming together and being able to talk things very freely with each other.
Well, let's try and explore some of the close relationships that the pair of you have actually had. So, Mike, obviously the character of Betty, was played by Pam Craig, died of a second heart attack less than a week after listeners were shocked by the first one in 2005. Pam decided to leave the show to be close to her grandchildren in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your relationship with your on-air wife.
I was married to Pam longer than I'd been married to the two ladies in my life, my first wife and my second. We were married to, you know, for 34 years.
Wow, really?
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, from the moment I came in to the moment she left, when we joined the program, it was a good 34 years. Mm. So coming into the studio after Pam had gone was really weird. Very weird, you know. And we were friends in real life as well. We met.
So did you know all about her decision to leave?
Oh, yes.
She confided in you.
Yeah. We talked. Well, she talked about it to Vanessa, and then said, "Would you like to talk to Terry about it?" And I fully understood. You know, I'd known her from her first marriage. She was married to the guy Terence, who was the "You're Never Alone with a Strand" man.
Mm.
You remember that?
Really?
The one that killed off Strand cigarettes.
He looked
remarkably like Frank Sinatra.
Next to a river.
Yeah, and by a lampshade, you know.
On
a rainy day. She was married to him for many years until he died. And I remember I went going to his funeral while she was in the program with me. And then she met somebody else, and they got very well, lived in the Malverns. But his family were all in New Zealand, and it got to a point where he'd retired. The only thing that Pam was doing was the Archers, and there wasn't a vast amount of that. And she just thought, you know, I'd like to go, you know, leave. And she made the decision. She said, right, I'm giving it up. I'm going to go over to New Zealand and have a new life over there, which she did. Then we were faced, obviously, with the thing of, what do we do? You know, do we kill her off? Do we, you know, actually kill her on air? What do we do? And Vanessa talked to me about it at the time and said, you know, would you be happy with this happening? You know, I said, well, I'm not happy with Pam leaving, but I mean, that's her choice. That's got to happen if she wants to go, you know. So, yeah, we've got to find a way around that. And I think they did a phenomenal job of writing that storyline of Betty's death and the, you know, the aftermath of that for Mike and for Brenda and Roy.
I'll tell you what, Terry, it was the first time I actually liked Mike Tucker.
Really?
Yeah, you're a miserable old sod.
I got your blooming address, Royfield Brown. You'll be round there, I can tell you. Well, I'll send Vicky round, actually.
She'll see to it.
I went over, I was in New Zealand a few years ago, and I met up with her just before her second husband died, sadly. And I was aware that was beginning to happen. And, hoping one day our paths will meet again, because she was a very special lady and she meant a lot to me over the years. Like Tim has said with Paddy. You know, it's somebody, you know, you have them in your life, and they are, you become one on the programme with that relationship.
For me, Norman Painting, Phil Archer, was always the patriarch of the show, at least when I came in about 84 as a listener. Tim, how was it working with somebody who'd been around from episode one in 1951? And were you actually close to him?
Daddy!
Hey, watch her, Grace, she's terrified!
Oh my God, this is ghastly. Get out of it, quickly!
This is Isabella and Judy in those boxes at the end!
Yes, all right, but you get out, Grace, go on, get out!
Look, it's down in the straw in the boxes near the door. We'll have a hell of a job getting the horses past.
Well, drive them. Come on, get up. Go on, stupid, move.
Phil!
Stand clear, Grace. We're coming out in a rush.
Come on, Judy.
They're all out now.
Yes, take these two. Okay, I've got Judy.
I've got the other.
It's an inferno in there.
Midnight!
Oh, my gosh, we're lucky to get him out.
Yes, certainly were.
Look, she's going back into the stable.
What?
No, Grace. No, don't do it.
She's going in after midnight. Grace!
Grace! Grace, come back! The roof's collapsing!
Phil, you fool!
Let me go! Grace is in there! Let me go, blasted!
It sounds sort of strange, but there were kind of similarities with him and my father. Not physically, not in many ways, but one of the things that he had in common with my father, they were both extremely well-read and had an opinion about absolutely everything. And I was brought up to argue, you know, with, mm-hmm. with my pa. My pa would come up with some kind of sweeping generalization, and I would come and join in, and we'd have, you know, absolute major sort of ding-dongs about things that we both knew a certain amount about. And that happened with Norman, and I really, really enjoyed that. One of the extraordinary things was that he wrote Archer scripts under the name of Bruno Milner. But the other thing that he did that is very little known is that he actually wrote a few scripts under the name of Norman Bentinck, spelt the same name as me, exactly the same. And then his son suddenly came in, cast as Timothy Bentinck, which is, you know, because our name's fairly rare. I mean, it was such an extraordinary coincidence that should happen. Yes, and Norman used to pontificate and, you know, sometimes to excess. I mean, Norman would not draw breath when he was telling you sort of stories about things, to the extent that Paddy came up with one of the funniest lines that I've ever heard her say. After Norman died, Paddy came in for her first episode without Norman, you know, ever. And Jill had always been in the shadow of Phil, and likewise, Paddy had always been in the shadow of Norman, and it had been written thus. And so Paddy very, very politely had always just kept quiet and let Norman, you know, go on, and she would bite her lips and bite her peace. And so after she came back into the green room, having done her first episode without Norman, I said, Paddy, what was that like, darling? That must have been you know, a bit different. She said, it was strange. Very strange. Nice. And we all just packed up on the floor because it's that wonderful dry delivery that Paddy's got, you know. Nice. After all these years, you know, I've actually got, as it were, I've got my own show, you know.
Here we are. Come in.
Thank you.
Oh, what a lovely day we've had.
Phil's got his music on. What's the betting he's having a nap?
Oh, lovely and warm.
Put the kettle on, can you, Chris?
Right. Oh, yes. A cup of tea would be lovely.
I'll just see if Phil would like a cup. There you are. You've already had a cuppa, I see, Phil. Phil? Oh. Jill? Oh, no. Phil. Oh. No, Phil.
I just remembered that Norman brought the mic into the program.
Oh.
He wrote one of my first episodes.
Oh. Yeah, yeah. I think so he was regularly writing in the 70s. And
oh, yeah. I regularly had stuff from Bruno Milner. Yeah, I remember him well.
And wow. I had this strange thing, which had never been done in the program. When was it? About a year ago, when David's having a bit of a kind of a crisis, and he hears his father, he hears the voice of Phil in his ears, and they. Mm-hmm. They played this recording of Norman coming in saying, "I've decided I'm going to give Brookfield to David and Ruth, David and Ruth, David and Ruth," and having to do that, and with my own father having died, it was one of those no acting required moments because I was required to choke up a bit, and sometimes in the program your emotions get the better of you. And as an actor, you use that, rather than saying, well, I'm going to do it. No, I'm feeling like crying, so I will, And it's moments like those sometimes where truth and fiction
merge
and you're not acting anymore. It's actually, you're trying not to cry, and that was very moving. And it brought back, the memories of working with Norman. The other thing, of course, about Norman was that he was quite small and he wasn't a very sort of tough guy, but he sounded, he always sounded like a big, burly farmer. He had the nature of the voice of Phil. People always often said this to me, that he sounded like, a tough, strong, physical man. And I'm 6'3" and Norman was about 5'6" or something. So, and I could never get that picture out of my head. I've got to remember that he's a big, burly, tough. Yeah, good old Norman.
Yeah. And he has a star on Broad Street. Yeah,
he does.
He does.
Talking about where fact and fiction overlap. Mary Wimbush, who played Julia Pargiter, died on the evening of the 31st of October in 2005 at the BBC at the Mailbox, shortly after completing a session for The Archers.
Yeah.
Can either of you remember that day?
Yeah, I was. I think I'd just gone because I was in that episode. But she died in Alison Dowling's arms on the stairs. I mean, halfway down the stairs, she collapsed. She was going to the train. Alison was with her. When she collapsed and literally died in her arms. And, as all actors say, way to go. Because, absolutely. You want to... Most actors don't give up acting. It's usually acting that gives them up. And it didn't with her. She carried on doing it right until the end. I actually knew Mary before I was in The Archers and before she was in The Archers because she was a friend of my parents. So I smoked my first cigarette with her son Charles upstairs in her room in her house, in a little cottage in Albury, just outside Tring. And the parents were downstairs having a rip-roaring time, and I'd been brought along. And, her recalcitrant and naughty son, Charles, said, "You're not a cigarette." Oh, my word. And I was very young. So I always shared a naughtiness, with Mary. And, again, she was a bit like Margot. She was, she had liked her G&Ts and would sit down and regale you with stories, and was a woman who was quite fond of a drop or two and a cigarette. And she was the sort of female equivalent of a hellraiser. She was great. She was naughty and
funny. She had quite a naughty early life as well. But a phenomenal actress. I mean, I worked with her a lot on radio. Before the Archers, and she had that gravel voice, which just
amazingly deep voice
stopped you in your tracks. She always seemed to be playing my mother, and I can always remember that. It was you didn't say no when Mary said here. It was she was a force. She really was, and a great loss. But I mean, my gosh, what a way to go! I mean, I'll count me in for one of those. I'll be happy to do that too.
And the program needs those characters. Needs those eccentric and different and absolutely instantly recognizable voices.
Definitive, I mean, that's what's given the program its texture over the years. It's that differentiation between the characters, the age, the social standing, whatever it may be. Yeah. But, you know where you are. You we've painted the picture and everyone can see us and really actually, you know, they've got that picture, be it Norman at 6'4", you know, and barrel chested and striding across the land and or whoever it may be, you know.
Yeah.
That's in the listener's mind. And it comes from those very definitive voices, which are not necessarily polished performance voices. They have come from life.
Absolutely.
And that's what makes it special.
That is a perfect point to end, gentlemen. We should do this all again sometime and go through some more characters. But before...
Want to go through the ones we hate?
we've been so tactful, Terry.
We've been so tactful. Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Both of us trying to think how to say this nicely.
And actually talk to each other without swearing,
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Now, you two shush, because we're about to pop down under for a little touch of Millie Bell.
When you don't have a roof over your head,
build that wall. Build that wall.
There was nothing marked classified on my emails either sent or received.
Build that wall.
I am humbled to have been chosen by the Conservative Party to become its leader.
Said Britain is just a small island that no one pays attention to.
A former colony won the right to determine its own destiny.
Hello and welcome to Mid-Atlantic, the show where we look at the news and the views from one side of the ocean from the perspective of the other.
Do you have a National Trust sticker on your car? Do you think you could be best friends with Kath Kidson? Do you spend hours wandering around the airport looking for an organic quinoa cafe because you refuse to go to Burger King? Then Sarah Smith Cloths offer you. Available from Sainsbury's for the posher washer. Proud sponsors of Dumpty Dum.
G'day everyone. Now, I don't know if you remember, but in the early days of Dumpty Dum, when I first started doing the roundup, I would often talk about what was happening on the other Facebook pages to do with the archers. But now our page is so busy that I really only have time to talk about our page, which is just fantastic, isn't it? If you're on the Dumpty Dum forums, you could this week have been talking about the Ambridge Bake Off, which was started by Kenny Koala Bear. Jill Has Totally Flipped Out, But, which was started by Miss Mid-City, and Kate Lyle saying, I know why Jill is so anti-Toby. So that's some nice little discussions happening there, and I really do encourage you to go jump on there and get involved and meet a few new people. And our Facebook page is getting more and more likes every week. So please, if you've been a member of that page for a while, keep the conversation happening, although it's been fantastic this week, because I think it will encourage new people to start making their voices heard as well. So this week we were talking about Salieri. We I was originally worried about Salieri, but perhaps we should all have been worried about Bartleby. Was he? Were all our favourite animal actors heading for the green paddock in the sky? Bit of a discussion there, but Mint, but no time said. Plot prediction: when Bartleby goes, so will Joe. And I don't know why, but that made me look a bit sad. And Robin Winning said, Bartleby is the only Grundy I like. We also discussed whether it's reasonable after a breakup to just leave the belongings outside the house. You know, I didn't know if he was just being snippy or if that's what you did. And Rachel Kennedy said, if Rob had a shred of regard for Henry, then he would have packed up all his stuff and taken it over to Bridge Farm as soon as Henry moved there. And actually, I hadn't really thought about it, but of course, throwing out Helen's things is one thing, but to throw out Henry's as well when he's saying that he really loves Henry, it just doesn't make any sense. Judith Lawrence said, no, legally you have a duty of care to the items. I have recently dealt with a similar situation, being a Kirsty to a friend. The professional advice is to box the belongings up carefully, contact the other person to agree a neutral location with a date and time suitable to all. And I must admit, that all does make much more sense to me. I'm surprised by how often Pat and Tony just cave in to whatever Rob says, because I don't think I'm that confrontational, but I'm sure I won't be putting up with his crap. We also talked about the second week of Jill Oh My. Quite a discussion on there. Alicia Wallace says, I agree that Jill is being petulant, but all I hear when Pip talks to Toby is, remember that time you lied? Ha ha, that was fun. Why does your brother give you such a hard time for being a cruel coward? Let me help support your awfulness. I just made you dinner and I still have to bribe you with sweets like a small child before you'll consider helping clean up. But even with a bribe, you still won't do it. Let's move in together. I can barely keep from retching. Alicia, that was really well done. Good job. And then finally, we were talking about the fact that some flags have been going up for us. Alice keeps saying she would never have an affair. Emma doesn't trust Ed with other women. Are we joining too many dots here? Caroline Moss says, I thought the same. But do you think if they were going to do that, they might start giving Chris a few speaky bits first to bring him back into the fold? If Chris suddenly finds his voice, again, that could be a game changer. I thought that was a lovely way to put it, a few speaky bits. Charlie Room said, I think Emma is more concerned that Alice isn't paying for Ed's advice than that Ed will fall for Alice's somewhat dubious charms. I think you're right, Charlie. I just think she is a little bit of a jealous person, and that while she might not start out being suspicious of him and Alice, I think she might end up being, I don't know. Glenn Day After thought the same as the rest of us. And Witherspoon, as always, just says, answer to question, nope. Valerie Bayliss finished with, I do hope they don't go down that hackneyed route. I hate it when you can see plots coming from a mile off and it's so unrealistic. It is, isn't it? But that's our discussion for this week. We would love to see you on either the Facebook or on the forum in the next week. So please jump on. Your conversation is what makes it interesting. So until next week, from me, hooroo!
Thank you, Millie Bell. As always, that was Tip Top and Buttonhole. Folks, we have a shop. Go to dumdydum.com and you can go and get your merchandise that says dumdydum on it, like cups and t-shirts and whatever. Go there. Also, we've got a forum. So you can go there and tell us what you thought about this special show. And if you thought maybe Terry and Tim should have been a little bit more indiscreet. Anyway, go on to dumdydum.com. It's all the iTunes reviews. Please send them in. We love them. They help us get up those podcasting charts with all of your reviews. We'll read out a few soon. Now, you can help us keep our little show on the road by donating. You can do that by hitting the donate button on our website. It's not obligatory. You can just do it if you've got any spare change in your pocket. Or you can go to patreon.com and give us $2 per show. Again, it's not obligatory, but if you want to, that'd be tip top. Remember to get in contact with us. You can do that by getting onto SpeakPipe on our website, or you can call us on 0203 031 3105 to leave us a telephonic message. Now, you're probably wondering, where are our calls this week? Because it's a special week, we've decided to do two shows this week, and one of them will be a show just of your calls. Now, on social media, you can find us where we're at DumDeeDum. Me, I'm at Royfield. Harriet is at Sandbridges. Sarah Smith, our wonderful sponsor, is at Sarah_Smith. And Lucy, at Lucy_Freeman. Tim, how can people find you on Twitter?
I'm at Tim Bentinck, all one word, and you've got to spell it right. It's Bentinck, so Tim Bentinck, all one word.
And what about you, Terry?
At Tucker's Patch. You see what I did there? Clever, isn't it?
On Facebook, you can go and find us by simply typing in DumDeeDum, and there's a good couple of thousand of you there. I believe you have your own appreciation society on there, Mr. Bentinck.
I do. They're very nice to me on the David Archer Appreciation Group. I don't get any trolls there. They're not allowed. And everyone treats me with kindness and hugs. Which we need. We just like it there.
You're a needy actor.
No, but I have come across some trollery in the past, and having been right at the beginning of the, I was writing websites, you know, right at the very, very early days of the internet, of the CompuServe bulletin boards, and I was writing computer programs and selling it there. And so when the whole thing came along of, you know, the kind of tie up with the Archers and Twitter, I thought, oh, this is a good thing. And I saw, you know, early tweet alongs. I have to say, one of the funniest things I ever saw was when Nigel fell off the roof, and it was an early tweet along, and that was the first time I'd ever seen it. And I said, come on, are you a man or a mouse, Nigel? Come up on the roof. And somebody said, you're going to have to get the beeper out here. Okay, get ready with the beeper. Okay. Somebody wrote in capital letters, don't go up on the fucking roof. And I thought that was wonderful. And then it sort of started to get out of hand, really. And I thought, now I'm going to back off because there's too much insults flying about. And there's no repercussion to it. So I backed out of it.
We can be a peculiar lot, us Archers fans. We come at this from an absolute point of personal ownership, don't we? So sometimes people don't know where the drama and real life kind of, you know, starts and ends, and they merge the two and believe that they can, you know, have some kind of direct influence on scripts. It is actually quite a bizarre thing. But I suppose on the one hand, it's a massive backhanded compliment to the power of your craft, gentlemen, that you can paint these realistic paintings for us in our ears.
We're absolutely completely prepared and take it on board that somebody should have a go at the character, because that's what we're doing to you. You know, it's written in order for you to shout at the radio. We're performing it for you to shout at the radio. We know what we're doing. It's done on purpose. We're manipulating you in that sense. But sometimes it goes over where people have a go at the actor, and then that's not fair, because then you're mistaking what, you know, the character that we've created for the person who's the voice behind it, and that's not right. Mm.
I think also, I mean, in the world of fandom in general, I think the Archers fans generally tend to have their tongues planted firmly in their cheeks.
Yeah.
We don't have anoraks following us. We have barbers. You wouldn't have anoraks, I tell you, no. Absolutely not.
Just before we completely go, gentlemen, obviously you guys are jobbing actors. Is there anything else that you're working on, and anything else that you want to plug just before we all say goodbye to our listeners?
I'm doing a series of little indie films at the moment, one of which I'm really looking forward to, which is about homelessness. And I've been getting more into indie films just recently, and also doing a bit of stage stuff. I'm over Christmas, I'm doing, rather than doing a jolly Christmas show, I'm doing two ghost stories by M.R. James, a stage versions of, you know. And I think they're going to be really good. Just doing limited runs in a couple of places around the Eastern counties, but I'm really looking forward, because I've not been on stage for ages, and it's really nice to get your feet wet again from time to time. Those I'm certainly looking forward to, and enjoying life, as they say, even though I'm still stuck in Birmingham. But there we go.
Well, you are going to get the call back, though, aren't you?
I don't know.
Well, we hope so. Well, I hope so. Yeah, We've been missing Mike Tucker.
I know, yeah. I was listening the other day and they were talking about the Cider Club being refurbished. I said, well, I thought, well, where's Mike? He should be going there, you know, breaking a bottle to open it up, shouldn't he?
Absolutely.
I hope sometime soon some resolve will be made to bring the Tucker family back into the fold.
Absolutely, absolutely. What about you, Mr. B? What are you working on at the moment?
Well, I've had a strange year. I've had the year of the Roth, because I did this low-budget British movie where it was me and Jack Roth, who's Tim Roth's son, in a thing called Us and Them, which is about a home invasion, and I'm the posh banker with his family, and Jack and his gang come in and tie us up and torture us, and I get half drowned in my own private swimming pool. But that was the first lead I've had in a film for a while. So that's going to be out fairly soon. And then, just by complete coincidence, I did this thing called Reg, which was a wonderful Jimmy McGovern script all about this guy called Reg Keyes, who took on Tony Blair at the Sedgefield 2005 general election because his son had been killed in Iraq. And I played Frederick Forsyth, the novelist who went on the campaign trail with him. So I had three really nice scenes where it was basically me talking and Tim Roth standing next to me, which is quite one of those big movie stuff. And then the next job I got a small part in this thing called Rillington Place, which is basically a three-part BBC series remake of 10 Rillington Place, all about the murderer Christie. And so I went to the costume fitting and I said, all right, and who's playing Christie? And she said, oh, it's Tim Roth. I mean, blimey, that's three Roths in a row. I play his doctor. It's a small part. But no, the big one, it's a small part in a very big movie, because I'm in the new J.K. Rowling movie, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, and that comes out in November. And if you go to the Comic-Con trailer for Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, it starts with a blank screen and my voice over the top of it, because I'm from the Bronx and my character is called Witness. And basically I start the movie with me and Colin Farrell, and we're in New York in 1926, and I'm describing this mist. It was like a mist, it was like a ghost, and it had white, shining eyes, and it dove down underground. And then that's the end of my part. But
exciting!
It starts very well, but watch out for the first.
I could see you on the convention circuit before long, Tim.
Yeah, you know what I mean. I'm hoping so, mate. I need to make some money on that one. So yeah, it's been quite varied, and voiceovers and things like that. So it's been like
Tim, Terry, let's get you back on again. Maybe before Christmas, if we can squeeze it in, and let's do this all again.
Excellent. And this is probably the first time we're going to say it this year, but a happy Christmas to all.
It was like a ghost. I saw its eyes, shining white eyes, and it dove down underground.
The strange things going on all over the city. The people behind this are not like you and me. There's a hidden society. It goes back centuries.
Yesterday, a wizard entered New York with a case. A case full of magical creatures. And unfortunately, some have escaped.
Teeny, you brought Matt home.
That's Mrs. Commander. He's lost something I'm going to help him find.
We're going to recapture my creatures before they get hurt. They're currently in alien terrain, surrounded by millions of the most vicious creatures on the planet.
Humans.
Magical beasts are terrorizing nomadges. When nomadges are afraid, they attack. Contain this, and it'll mean war.
Put this on.
Why would I have to wear something like this?
Because your skull is susceptible to breakage under immense force.
Oh.
and there's absolutely nothing to worry about.
I want to be a wizard.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.